Warning. Please note this documentary contains language and discussion from the start, which some listeners may find distressing and offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Previously on Turnstiles to Touchlines. We're well into our journey now too, and constantly in the back of our minds has been a want and a need for us to discover the fastest growing and most exciting part of the game, women's football. But if there's one thing we've learnt, nothing is always as it seems.
For example, look what's happened to Coventry. They're a team that they were all on full-time contracts only this last year, and 2 days before Christmas being told that they haven't got a job.
Since the return of fans to stadiums post-COVID, it seems as if there's a new incident involving fans every week, whether that be the scenes at the final of the 2020 European Championships at Wembley, a racial social media post, or just something kicking off at your local non-league club.
I'm Owen Taylor.
And I'm Jack Carson.
And we wanted to go on a journey to find out if there's a troublesome culture returning in English football, and are we regressing to a time where football hooliganism was the norm?
Welcome to episode 4 of From Turnstiles to Touchlines. Over the past few years, the women's game has been on the rise, it's getting more recognition and it's becoming more accessible.
A BBC report showed 2021 was a record-breaking year for viewing figures when it came to women's sport, with it pulling nearly 33 million people, 6.2 million of which were viewers for the Women's Super League. I must say this episode is certainly one of mixed emotions. The passion the women we spoke to had for football was second to none, and their enthusiasm was infectious.
And while the women's game is on the rise, there's a dark side to the game that still probably isn't heard enough.
Top two leagues, that gap between tier two and tier three is absolutely huge, absolutely huge. You don't just win the league and you're automatically in. You have to win your league, play in a playoff game against the Southern National League, and then you have to prove that you've got the finances to go in the league. So you could win both of those games and actually not go into the championship, but they could just say no. And it's happened, a couple of seasons ago. Blackburn, I think, won the league twice and they didn't go up.
Now, I'm going to be really honest with you here, Jack. I haven't watched as much women's football as I could have or probably should have. I do remember watching the Women's World Cup on TV when that was in France back in, that's 2019 now.
Look, I'm going to be honest as well, Owen. I'm probably in the same boat. Even one of my housemates plays women's football. But I think one thing we can agree on is that since Sky have won the Women's Super League rights and we're seeing more women's football on terrestrial TV, I have started watching it a lot more and starting to learn a lot more about it.
Spot on. And you know, with the Women's Euros being in England this summer, it's a great opportunity to not only get people like you and me watching, but really bring the whole nation together again like the men's team have and boost the popularity of women's football.
Well, this is it exactly. We're going to come on to the Euros later. But coming to this part of the journey, myself and Owen wanted to speak to someone who's been there, done it. And we were fortunate enough to speak to someone who's had an illustrious career in the game. And she's played for some of the biggest teams in England. And her love for football started from a young age.
I'm Chloe Jones. I'm a retired professional footballer. I've played in the Women's Super League for Liverpool. I've played for Aston Villa, Leicester City, Wolverhampton Wanderers. And then professionally over in Finland for Åland United. I mean, I always say to people that, I mean, I'm a twin, I've got a twin sister, so I always say that I was born as a team, and I was born very competitive, so I think it just lent its hand to sport in general. My family have always been really sporty. My dad played at quite a high level football, but had to stop because he had a back injury. I think my mum would have played football, but it was pretty much netball all the time at a school, so she wasn't allowed to do that. And from a young age, we love sport, we love being active, and it was very much of, you know, any kind of, I don't know, school camps, after school clubs or holiday camps or anything on the weekend evenings, you know, swimming, dancing, whatever, you know, give it a go, let's work, you know, have a go and see what you enjoy. And my two things were football and swimming. And my sister was dancing. I wasn't the best at that, to be honest. I just went there for the nice cafe at the end. But yeah, I didn't really, obviously at that young age, you don't know anything about, you know, stereotypes or anything like that. You just do something that you love. And it wasn't till, because, you know, primary school, you're a child and everyone plays the same games. Everyone plays tick, everyone plays football or whatever. And then it was when we got later on in primary school, and the boys' team had a football match, and I was like, "Well, what's going on? Like, why haven't we got a football match?" And it was our math teacher at the time, and he said, you know what, we've got enough girls this year, so we'll set a team up. We won't play in the league, but we'll play just against some of the other primary schools. And we did that. And from that, he put me, my sister, and a couple of others forward to go for kind of the Walsall Girls School Trials. And I was dead upset because I got in and my sister didn't. I was pretty chuffed as well, but I was upset because it was like, oh my God, you're taking me away from my twin sister, because she liked football as well. And it just went from there, really. And you know, I think Mr. Griffiths, he's the teacher at the school, and went to secondary school. And I think it was about in year seven, we played for Walsall team. We played for a team called Silverdale, which was just a local team. And then it was a summer and we were old enough, you know, go to like school holiday camps and stuff. And we grew up in Walsall, so Wolves were the closest, biggest team. And we went to just a soccer camp, you know, for a week at a school nearby. And it just happened to be, we were the only girls that went there. And it just happened that the academy coach for the girls was there, and then he invited us down for one of the trials. I was like, God, I didn't even know Wolves had a team, and you know, I didn't even know that was the setup. We were only like 11, so me and my sister went to trials. We got in, played for the Wolves Academy, which is called the Centre of Excellence at the time. Played for the weekend team, and then we just went from there, really. You know, up the age groups, but, you know, part of the academy. I was in Wolves' first team when I was 14, which was, it sounds like it's unheard of, but I'm not saying it happened a lot, but it happened because it, you know, law allowed you to. I was captain of Wolves when I was 18, so captain of the first team when I was 18.
One thing I picked up on there, Jack, which Chloe said, was that there was no football team at a school, and the fact that her and her sister were the only girls to turn up to a soccer training camp.
As of March 2022, currently only 63% of schools offer football to girls in PE, and only 40% offer extracurricular. Now, whilst it's more than what there has been in the past, it's still not a lot. That being said, steps are being taken. The Let Girls Play campaign, launched by the FA and Barclays, hosted sessions in 1,450 primary and secondary schools in an attempt to get 75% of schools offering football for girls in PE lessons, 90% offering extracurricular access to the game by 2024. And football is more accessible for young girls now than it has ever been.
And the task is to make it the norm for girls to want to play football and for them to have that option as a career, as Chloe explained.
The pathway that you described to becoming a professional, do you think it's easier now, or do you think it's a better pathway now?
I think it's more accessible, I say, because as much as I loved football, and you know, if anyone asked me what you want to be, I was, well, obviously a professional footballer, and everyone would laugh in my face and think, no, you won't. Like, I probably fell in it and fell in it at the right time, and you know, it was lucky. Now it's kind of more. I'd definitely say more accessible and more kind of well known now. And, you know, clubs are well known to have really good pathways for youngsters, even starting at, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8. Whereas as I think it started under 10, so it was starting quite late. But yeah, I think it's definitely more accessible. And you've got your role models as well, haven't you? I've been super lucky. When I say laughed in my face, it never felt to me like it was, I don't know, like in jest, other than when I say laughed in my face, it was only because when I was that young, it wasn't an option. So it was more like, well, that's, you know, laughing in, like, what, that's not even a profession, like, you can't get paid for it. So what are you? So I've never been bullied by it. But I do think that is... I just think they bother me, even if I did, to be honest. I'd just shrug it off and be like, well, I love, you know, it's what I love. So, you know, I'm all for kind of raising people up, not putting them down. So I only ever would have used it to motivate than anything.
In 2021, former Premier League referee Mark Clattenburg made a comment stating, women have to choose to be pregnant or referees.
It's just plain ignorance, isn't it? It's ignorance. And I think it's, misogyny, and I think it's just, there's good people and there's bad people, and there's very, you know, ignorant people. But, you know, I think look at the impact that's had on, you know, on them and their careers, because, like I said earlier, we should be raising people up, not putting them down. And who on earth is is he to say comments like that when, well, I you know, he should try, you know, giving birth and see how he deals with that. It's one of the hardest jobs that you can do. We've gone a long way than that, and I think it's the level of challenge as well. It's the level of challenge to say, you know what, we're not accepting that anymore, and we shouldn't have to. But you know, I think it's, we talk about the players, we talk about the coaches, but it's a career for, you know, like I say, like a sports analysis and, you know, the match officials and VAR. You know, I had someone that used to play for with Villa actually worked on VAR when it first came out. And obviously, you know, behind the scenes, but actually you would never know that it was a female behind that screen. You just trust that you almost assume that it's a male, don't you? But again, it's the right person for the job.
One woman making those accessible pathways into the women's game is Gina Beardmore, and she's a player coach for local Sunday league team, Chelsea Colts. And we went down to watch a game and find out about her journey in football and the work she does now. I'm actually really, really excited for this. Almost at the playing field now. I've been to Gina on the phone before this to set this up. Sounds like somebody who's, you know, when you just get the feeling somebody's really, really passionate about their job. This is, that's the feeling I got on the phone from her anyway. So very much looking forward to meet her in person after, of course, we've watched a cracking game of football. And what a game it was too. 6-5, and Gina got not one, not two, but a hat-trick in the game.
I was a player for a while, and then after that I sort of went, I need to just want to manage it because I'm getting old, I'm getting on now. So I thought I'll manage it for a bit, but at the moment I still play and manage.
Yeah. How long have you been here at Chelmsley Colts?
Chelmsley, this is my third year at Chelmsley. But before that I played in the army a long time ago, for years, since I was about 5, I think I've been playing football. And then I played in the army for a long time, then stopped playing because I just got too old and fat. And then I've started again now, 3 years ago.
And what's the, I guess, the difference from when you started playing girls football, I guess, to now? Have you seen like a rise, a change?
Oh my God, massively. I stopped playing because I didn't think girls football was going anywhere. There was not a thing about women being on TV playing football when I was younger. I'm 35, so you can imagine how different women's football is now. They're actually playing on TV, like girls playing football. So for me, that is the best thing that's come out of women's football, is seeing women on BBC playing football, because I never thought it would happen when I was a kid.
And does that help you try and like recruit players here, like, and play for your Chelsea Colts?
It does a little bit, yeah. You get players, but you sometimes get very new players. And this is a thing. At Chelmsley, we're happy to take in them players. We don't mind. If you've never played football, we want you to come and play for us, because we will coach you and build you up and get you playing. Some teams in Birmingham won't take you unless you're at such a level. But we'll take anybody, because we want everyone to learn and have the opportunity to play 90 minutes of football every weekend and full-on adults women's football.
And I guess the Women's FA Cup final's on today. It's like you say, it's stuff like that being on TV that gives, I guess, girls the confidence that maybe are sitting home thinking, should I play, should I not? It gives them the confidence.
Yeah, it does, yeah. Them games are so important. To see women playing at that level are really important, I think, for the younger kids, or even women who just never even played football, but they just like the look of the game and want to think, oh, I want to go with that. Yeah, they can come here and do that. And that's the best thing about this team, is we are very welcoming and there's no trials to get in. You just come, have a laugh. We've got a really good friendly team. Have a laugh and come and play football, because that's all we're about, is just playing football.
And you got your first win today as well of the season.
Your first win of the season, yeah. It's been a long time coming, I think. It's been a well-deserved win, I think. I think we've worked very hard, and considering this is the first season for 90% of them players, it was hard to get the morale up, because I had to explain to them that you don't just gel together as a team, you have to play for so many months. And now that's happened, this win is going to ramp up everyone's morale and hopefully go into next week with a fresh lease of life.
We'll go best and worst moment. What's your best moment that you think you've had in football?
In football?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm talking like 20 years ago, aren't we now? I think probably when I was little, scoring my first ever goal. Do you know what I mean? The feeling of playing a full-size pitch when you're sort of 9 and 10 and then scoring a proper goal, it's like when you get your first big meal at McDonald's, isn't it? It's a proper leap forward. Yeah. My worst moment, I think, was when I got a red card not long ago, because as a manager, I went onto the pitch because I didn't agree with one of the girls shouting at our girls, and I just won't have it. So the ref did give me a red card because I walked onto the pitch. So that was a bad example.
You want to be a role model, but sometimes it's the game, it's the passion that gets hold of you.
It's the passion that gets hold of you. Yeah, that's what got me. The passion got me. And I just had to go on. I couldn't deal with it. The passion got hold of me. But I told him afterwards I shouldn't have done it, but I would probably do it again.
And for people at home that are thinking about, what's your advice? What's your advice for girls, women even sitting at home thinking, I'd love to do that, but I just think I'm either going to get taken the mick out of or whatever. What's your advice?
100% just go and do it. Find a team and go and do it and at least do one or two training sessions. And I guarantee the first 5 minutes you'll realise that nobody will take the mick out of you. Nobody is going to laugh at you because you can't kick a football. People will teach you how to play football and spend the time and energy on playing football with you. So definitely come along to any team and give it a go. It's always worth it.
Do you think that's the difference between maybe men and women's football? Is that with women's football, it's a lot more open. It's a lot more, I guess, diverse and accessible.
Yeah, definitely. Women's football is a lot more. We sort of look after each other a bit more, where men are very competitive, aren't they? So women more like to look after each other and help each other along rather than I'm against you, you're my competition. We're a team. Let's look after each other and do everything together as a team.
It's women like Gina that are actually the reason women's football is on a rise, because strip away the broadcasters, the money, the leagues, and go down to the very basics of football. On a Sunday, 22 girls on a pitch, kicking around a football, enjoying themselves, having fun, experimenting, trying a new game, trying something out for the first time. If people like Gina, coaches up and down the country that are creating the spaces that these women feel safe in to play and enjoy themselves.
Chloe mentioned before she was laughed at because, like she said, women's football at the time wasn't seen as a profession. So going back to her journey, after leaving Wolves, Chloe left to play for Crewe Alexandra and then her big break, signing for Liverpool and playing in the Women's Super League. But was there a moment where Chloe had doubts over football and did she regret leaving Liverpool when she did?
And I probably should have stayed a little bit longer because it was my choice to leave, but I'd done uni and I always had like my head screwed on that I needed a backup because women's football at the time, it was, oh, we took loads of money at it. And, you know, years before, you look at Johnny Bells and Fulham, they threw loads of money at it. They become professional. And then 1 year, they just took away all the funding. And so it was more like the trust in the game. And I thought, I need a plan B. One, if I get injured. Two, if they take the money off. So I trained to be a teacher. Went to uni, trained to be a teacher, got my first teaching job at a college in Worcester. So I worked there as a sports lecturer. And to be honest, it was how the travelling didn't break me at the time, I don't know. But it was kind of just a little bit of work-life balance. Like, I need to be a little bit more sensible. So that's when I moved to Aston Villa. I've never worked, lived and played so close to each other. It was lovely. But it allowed me to kind of be my physical peak, train before work, train after work, play. But I wasn't overly tired because I'd get home at a reasonable time and not have to get up stupidly early. So, yeah, so I did that. My teaching career was going up. So I became curriculum leader and was working my way up there. And then I got to 26 and I thought, you know, I've always been one. I love, you know, going to different cultures, learning different things. And, you know, I used to love going to Africa. We went there every year. I used to take like students there every year. And I thought, you know what, I'd love to play abroad. One of my coaches from Liverpool, he knew a guy, Gary Williams, that coached in Finland, well, Åland. And then I'd never been to Scandinavia, didn't know anything about it, but I don't know why something was pulling me towards it. And I thought, you know what, this is different because everyone goes to the States, everyone goes to, I don't know, Germany, Denmark or whatever. I thought, I'm gonna give this a go. And so, yeah, I went to Åland, played in the Nästan Liga for a year. Work gave me a sabbatical, so I was like secure. Obviously played professionally, absolutely loved it, played in the same team as, you know, people from Nigeria, Estonia, all over the world, America, Scotland, all over the world. And I think that was, and obviously Finnish and Swedish players, learned to speak a little bit of Swedish. Don't ask me now, I could understand it, but I don't think so I got to the end of that and I thought, you know, I was 27 28. Again, I probably should have stayed. Well, I probably could have stayed. Well, they wanted me to re-sign. And I said, oh, you know, I felt a little bit bad because work had given me a sabbatical. And I thought, they've trusted me with this. I'm going to go back, but I'll give it a go for the next 3 or so months. So I eventually ended up staying through my own choice. Because actually, you know, when you go back somewhere twice, it might not have been as good or it might not have meant that much to me. So I thought, you know what, it was a perfect time. Let's leave it there. And I've got lifelong friends from it. And, you know, I try and go. I haven't been for the last few years because of COVID, but I'm going to try and go in the summer back to Åland. You should go. Åland Islands, they're absolutely stunning. And it, the experience was brilliant because we used to have to, we played in the Finnish league, so we had to take cruise ships to get to games, to get to Finland and then travel, because obviously we lived at this set of islands, which it sounds really like, it was in the summer, it was like, it was so, so busy. Everyone, it was like the party island, and it was brilliant. And they loved women's football. I've never known an area that invests in such, in women. You were like royalty. You were absolute royalty there. So yeah, so I came back, carried on with my job, and actually I retired for a total of about 3 months because I thought I've done everything that I want to do. You know, I don't want to do any more.
So during Chloe's playing career, we wanted to know how big the growth of the women's game actually got, and we were fascinated by the difference in recognition when playing for Åland United in Finland.
I will say that actually, I think there's always been a lot of players that wanted to play. I think it's just been their opportunities to play. I think definitely the spectators, that's obviously grown, and Twitter paying attention. But, you know, a lot of, you still get the half that's the ugly stuff that, you know, you don't want to hear. But yeah, I think it's grown, and I like the fact that it's growing in it's becoming its own entity. Actually, we've stopped being in the shadow of, you know, male counterparts, and it's actually, let's be our own entity, let's be women's, like, you know, female football, rather than just, oh, that's the women's club of the men's. Well, no, it's, you know, they're both their own entity in their own right.
And you say, you know, when you were at Åland, you were treated like royalty. Just at that time when you moved from England, what was sort of like the attitude toward, the difference in attitude towards women's football in Scandinavia and in England?
It's massive. I mean, I did move over in the time where it was huge in England as well, but yeah, it was just honestly, you were known everywhere, and you know, I haven't done it to be famous or anything like that. I've just done it because it's the thing that I love, and now I'm thinking I can probably give something back. But they were, yeah, they were brilliant, and they knew who you were. You know, you'd be invited to, you know, alongside the male teams, and, or, you know, you were known as the absolute elite athletes of the islands and in the league, and you'd travel elsewhere, everywhere and stuff. But it just felt like it just, you were never being compared. I think, you know, it, again, like I say, we're moving away from that in England, but I think in, you know, like Scandinavia and America, you're never compared to anyone other than the teams in your own league, or, you know, the players in your team and things. It's never kind of a comparison with the male. And it helps that, all, like, for example, Åland, and there's a lot of clubs now that actually they haven't got a male. So there wasn't a male Åland team. It was called something completely different, so, which helped, I guess, because, you know, you had your own badge, and that was the women's team badge. So everyone knew you for that.
It's crazy, that difference between England and playing in Finland. I would have never thought football as a sport would be that big there, but I suppose being treated like royalty shows great potential for the women's game here, and something that we can look at to build on.
It's interesting we come onto this topic of being treated like royalty and being at the pinnacle of your sport, and you only have to look as far as the US women's national team, what they stand for and what they've achieved. Back in February, the women's US national soccer team reached a settlement in its equal pay lawsuit against the US Soccer Federation. ESPN reported US soccer agreed to pay $22 million in back pay to players and put $2 million into a fund for US women's national team players' post-career goals and charitable efforts, with each player able to apply for up to $50,000.
So, should we be paying the England women's team the same as the men?
I think it's really important. I think we would struggle for certain, only because the NWSL and, you know, soccer in America is absolutely huge. It's bigger for women than it is men. So actually, that is an absolute case, isn't it? So I think it was warranted. It was deserved. And actually, you know, I think a lot more of the women's players are more well known than the male players.
How long is it before we see that kind of brand they create in America, similar to something? Well, how long is it for our women sort of get that brand? Do you think we're near to that stage?
I think it's difficult when you've got the Premier League, that's the biggest, you know, football league in the world. But again, that's why I think it needs to just be looked at in its own right. I don't know whether it would ever be on par, or it might be, and it'd be fantastic if it is. I think we just need to. we're pushing in the right direction. I think the good thing with kind of women's football, I say that there's no ceiling because no one's ever done it before. So I think if we keep pushing and it's going the right direction, let's keep going in that direction.
But to reach that final destination, in the direction we're trying to go, there is still a lot of work to be done. And stick with us here, because you're going to want to hear what comes next. The side of the women's game that has gone under the radar for far too long. We pick up the story where, after becoming the head coach for the Stoke City women's team, Chloe has moved on to the role of technical director, a role which involves having meetings and being in charge of how to develop their women's team to the next level. However, what me and Erin were about to find out is often the reality of the women's game.
In the next 5 years, we wanted to get Championship and then WSL. So had meetings, obviously, with the club, spoke to the players, and even little things like the club didn't have names on their shirts. So, you know, got them then, got some sponsors, like really made it a really professional club, you know, included like S&C. You know, we had a really good physios anyway, but just made it a little bit more elite, because that's all I'd ever known. And then started kind of having meetings with the chief executive of the men's side, and, you know, proposals, and, you know, if you really want to invest, this is what you're gonna have to do. And it's not just about money, it's about feeling valued and appreciated. And that's the way that I was going. So I wasn't just saying, can I have a check, can give me a blank check and I'll do whatever I want with it. It was very much though, you know what, if you invest in these items here, even like GPS vests and stuff like that, so we've got those, we've got VO, so we could do a lot more analysis. And I was pushing, had the meetings, and to be honest with you, it was early March time, and it just got to the point where morally I was struggling, because there was no movement in it, and it was, as much as I don't know, you might have seen my Twitter post when I left, and it's no kind of bad blood towards anyone or anything like that. It's just, I just want Stoke to really take the opportunity, because they've got a really good bunch of players there and really good bunch of staff there, but there's only so far you can go with that when other teams are leapfrogging, not because they're better, it's just because they look after them a little bit more, they appreciate their value, they get paid, you know, even if it's expenses. You know, I had players that were spending £200 at least, you know, on every £200-£300 a month just to get to training. And I was having a phone call saying, I can't get training tonight because I can't afford the fuel. And I thought, we should never, in where we are right now, in the 21st century, where women's football are, in the tier three, no player should ever not be able to access the sport that they love at the level that they're playing it, because they can't afford it. So it just got to the point where I just kind of hit a brick wall a little bit, and you know, I just thought, I can't be involved in it. I will support the club and I want them to do well, and you know, I went to watch them on Sunday, and you know, I love them to bits, but I didn't want to resent them. I didn't want to, you know, get turned up to training and keep asking of so much from them and actually not being able to be the person that gives it, you know, them back. And so I'm hoping that they do take a step in the right direction, and I made it very clear that if they don't, then other teams are going to continue to leapfrog and Stoke are going to get left behind like they are this season a little bit. So that's why I decided to leave.
Now, this isn't a dig at Stoke, let's make that clear. It's just one example of what it's like at many clubs in the women's game. And actually, from some of the stories we've heard from Chloe, Stoke are still in a better place than most.
So how do we move away from this ground of women's teams being neglected? Research from Fair Game Group highlights how far football has to go before we can call it an inclusive space that represents females. As of March 2022, just 11% of board members at Premier League clubs were women, dropping to 4.2% in the Championship. So is female representation at board level a critical aspect in moving forwards?
I think the Premier League, and you know, there's all rumours, isn't there, of actually the Premier League, every Premier League team or anyone, if the Premier League take over the Football League or whatever, then every team has to have a women's team. And I think there has to be a level of support, definitely. I think it just to help kind of kick them off on their way, or allow teams, so you know, for example, Stoke, they weren't allowed to have their own kit sponsors or training sponsors or anything. It had to go into the men. It had to be a men's sponsor, but actually the women saw nothing of it. So I think it's actually just loosen the reins a little bit and allow them to go and get their own sponsors and go and get their own investment. because there's people, there's companies, there's business, and you know, I think it, like you say, it's, if they can be financially stable on their own, they're the teams that do well and are sustainable and consistent.
How involved in women's football are the PFA?
They are for the championship in the WSL. And I think that gap's getting bigger and bigger from the top, top two leagues. That gap between tier two and tier three is absolutely huge, absolutely huge. And, you know, it's not, you don't just win the league and you're automatically in. You have to win your league, play in a playoff game against the Southern National League. And then you have to prove that you've got the finances to go in the league. So you could win both of those games and actually not go into the championship because you can't financially have that. You've got to prove it's, you know, it's a whole business plan. So at the start of every season, the FA, so you can apply to go in just in case you win the league. But they could just say no. And it's happened, you know, a couple of seasons ago, Blackburn, I think, won the league twice and they didn't go up.
I mean, that's appalling. Through a hard, gruelling season, you could win all your games, win the league, and still not go up because you don't have the finances. I mean, what are you even bothering for at that point? It's shocking.
It's ironic. We always talk about how much money is in the men's game. And, you know, should there be wage caps to limit how much teams spend? Yet there's women's teams out there. And, you know, let's use the Blackburn example. Blackburn are a massive club, pushing at the top end of the championship this season. Of course, Premier League champions once. They've had Alan Shearer, Kenny Dalglish, names such as that. A big fan base. And the women's team couldn't even afford to be promoted after winning the league twice.
Well, the FA have announced that as of next season, the 2022-2023 season, the prize fund for the Women's FA Cup will go up to £3 million. Of course, the Women's FA Cup is growing in stature. 417 clubs entered this year's competition.
So what else is being done to increase the engagement in women's football? Of course, we have the Her Game 2 campaign, which has really come to the forefront of women's football in the 2021-2022 season. So what is Her Game 2? Well, founded in May 2021, Her Game 2 is a voluntary organisation run by female fans who are committed to growing a campaign in football where women are welcomed and respected equally. Many clubs have signed up to Her Game 2. Actually, it's quite a long list that includes the likes of Brentford, Everton, Leeds,
Birmingham, Fulham, West Brom, Bolton, Wigan, Shrewsbury Town.
Okay, Jack, let's leave it there. We'll be here all day. But if you want to see the full list of clubs who have signed up, you can do so on the Her Game 2 website.
Well, Shrewsbury Town dedicated their fixture on Easter Monday against Doncaster Rovers to the Her Game 2 campaign. And this saw all female ball retrievers, mascots, all female artists played over the PA, a female match ball sponsor, season ticket holders were able to give a female accomplice for 50% off. Both teams warmed up in Her Game 2 t-shirts before the kickoff and gave them away to members of the crowd as well.
I think it's brilliant because, again, it's not a tick box, it's genuinely investing in. No matter what role you want to play in the game, no matter what role, or if you just want to become a fan, try it and see if you enjoy the experience. And it's given the opportunities to people, and I think it's I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I think Shrewsbury Town are such a wonderful club because it's so inclusive, and you know, there's really, really good people that want to invest in both the male and the women's game, and they're doing it things in the right way. They're not you know, running before they can walk. They're doing it step by step, but they have got a clear vision of where they want to get to, and I'm really excited about that football club.
So Chloe's excited for the future of Shrewsbury Town, which, well, it brings a smile to Owen's face as he sits across from me. But what about the future for women in football? And so we come on to our final questions that we had for Chloe. Right, Chloe, one more thing before we let you go, because thank you so much for being on the call for so long. What are your visions for the future of the game? And after such a successful career of your own, what is your advice then for younger girls trying to get into the game?
It's hard to have a vision because you've got nothing to compare it to. And the fact that there's no ceiling, I think it's just making it an option for everyone, an opportunity for everyone. And no matter whether you want to be an elite player, play at the, you know, the highest level, or you just want to play recreationally, to be able to do that without the fear of, you know, being trolled, being, you know, having the barriers stopping you, and just for people to be able to do that comfortable and carefree and things. I think that would probably be what I want it to be. But I got given a bit of advice when I was about, it was just before actually I was going to play abroad, and it was someone that I work with, and I've never forget it. And she just said that, because you don't realise it when you're young, but she just said, she played netball at a really high level, and I think she did GB. I think she was a triathlete heptathlete or something. And she just kind of stopped me one day, and it was when I was in an RN about what to do, and she just stopped me and she said, you know, you need to, Richard, your sporting career is so short, and just enjoy every moment. And I think that is, you know, probably the best advice you can give, because I remember my first professional game, I remember my last professional game, and it just feels like it was just a blink and it was gone. And I think that would probably be it, you know, as long as they enjoy it. But I just think, just make the most of it, however you want it to look, and make the most of it, and just, you know, create your memories from sport, because it's over with a blink of an eye.
For girls up and down the country dreaming of becoming a professional footballer, they've got to start somewhere, grassroots. It seems fitting that me and Owen should end our journey where, for most professionals now, it all began. But does the culture of English football allow a fully functioning grassroots system? That's next on Turnstiles to Touchlines.
Next morning I woke up and thought, okay, 9 WhatsApp messages pop up, all from the dad, and he is like flaming abuse at me, like that I'd never seen before. And I looked at that and I was just like, what?
From Turnstiles to Touchlines was presented, produced and edited by Jack Carson and Owen Taylor, with thanks to Chloe Jones and Gina Beardmore for helping us in part 4 of our journey as we try to find out if there really is a troublesome culture plaguing English football. Trouble on my left, trouble on my right, I've been facing trouble.